Revelation chapter 12. Back in the book of Revelation this morning, Revelation chapter 12. When I read this, you're going to see why we say a mighty fortress is our God. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1. And a great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant, was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. Now, war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now, salvation and the power of the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, you dwell in them, but woe to you, O earth, and sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. When the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given 2 wings of the great eagle, so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time, and times, half time. Serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to help the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus." And he stood in the sand of the sea. He stood on the sand of the sea. Let me just say this about that last phrase. Some of your translations will translate that, "and I stood on the sand of the sea." It puts it with verse 13. That's the older Greek manuscripts here to have it that way. The better manuscripts have it with chapter 12, and it should be translated, "He," that is the dragon, "he stood on the sand of the sea." There is a, we sang "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." That hymn was written by Martin Luther. There's a legend, a story, possibly true, we don't know. With Luther, so many things became legend, so many things, so many tales about him. There were those who tried to, you know, oppose him, and they made up all kinds of things about him. But Luther was a character anyway. He was a character. But there's a story. It may be legend, it may be true. There's a story after the Diet of Worms, when Luther had stood before the world. Charles V, the emperor, had promised him safe conduct, and he was going to protect him. So he stands, the trial's over, and Frederick, who was the political leader of where Luther lived, Frederick made arrangements to have him kidnapped because he feared the Pope and Charles V and the Roman Catholic Church would not live up to their word, and they were going to have him killed. They wanted him dead, make no mistake. So Frederick has him kidnapped. He's taken to Wartburg. He's taken to a castle, and he's left there. It was for his own protection. He had no idea that that was happening. It's at that castle, it's at Wartburg, that he translates the Bible into German. He was there for some time. Well, there's a story that as Luther is writing, and as he's translating, and as he's working on this, he felt the presence of Satan so strong. The story goes, as Luther's working on this, his back's turned, and he felt as if Satan himself was right at his back, breathing down his neck, about to devour him. The story goes that Luther picked up the inkwell that was on the desk where he was working, turns, throws it at the devil. And you go and you tour those castles, and there's an ink spot there. And whether that actually happened or whether that's legend, still Luther understood full well spiritual warfare. And he writes about it, he talks about it, and he talks about feeling the presence of Satan, the archenemy of our souls. Let me ask you this question. What's behind coronavirus? What's behind it? What's behind the chaos? What's behind the unraveling of our culture? That's what's happening. You realize that, right? Our culture is unraveling right before our very eyes. So what's behind it? I know on one level you say, coronavirus, come on, it's natural causes. It's a virus, and we can, scientifically, we can look at it and say, okay, this is what it is, this is what we need to do. And, we can look at the unraveling of culture and say, well, come on, what's behind it? It's these radicals. It's these, depending on what political persuasion you are, it's these radical Democrats, right? Or it's these stupid Republicans. It's political. It's all this. It's about power. It's about that. And so, come on. That's what's behind all. Right? What about a spiritual dimension? Let me ask you this. Do you ever watch the news? Do you ever think in spiritual terms, it's like spiritual dimension? Do you ever watch something like a bomb going off somewhere? Do you ever watch something like a tsunami or a hurricane or... And think in terms of, man, I wonder spiritually, I wonder in the spiritual dimension, what's going on? Or do we just breeze through the news and think, oh, stupid people. These stupid politicians. That's what we need to do is we need to vote, right? Yeah, we do need to vote. What we need to do is get politically active, right? Yeah, we probably should do that. We live in a country where we have that freedom, and we should take advantage of it. Right? Because there are places in the world where people don't have that. So if we think in terms of spiritual dimension, then what about God? Is God behind coronavirus? Is God behind the unraveling of our culture? Is He doing something here? I don't know about God, but okay, then what about Satan? Is coronavirus satanic? Is the unraveling of our culture something coming from the very pits of hell? The very pit of hell? Is it satanic? See, do we even think in terms like that? Maybe sometimes we do. We read our Bibles and we come across passages like that. I know, we think, okay, well, that's big. Let me tell you this morning I leave the house. Alright, I leave the house. Because we go, okay, what about the small things in our life, right? What about the small things that I had to deal with yesterday? This morning I leave the house. I have a routine on Sundays. I like to stay to that routine. I like to stick to it. Okay? I'm not a very routine person all the time, but on Sunday mornings I have a particular routine I like to stick to. Shay is not here. Her back's hurting. She tells me, I'm not going. Okay, well, I'm going to take her vehicle. I usually take my truck, right? So I grab her keys, get in the car, drive all the way here, walk around to unlock the door. Guess what? They don't have my keys. I didn't grab my keys. At that moment, I got a choice, right? And I've been thinking about this passage the whole week. I've been thinking about spiritual warfare the whole week, right? So I could have said, oh man, you're stupid. And you're careless. What are you doing? And I could have thrown a fit, been out in the parking lot, throwing stuff, cursing, banging on the door. I did think about breaking in, but then I thought, well, if I get arrested, and I can just see people walking by, then the sheriff comes by. No, I promise you, I'm the pastor. I'm trying to get in. Maybe I could throw in a fit, right? People driving by say, what in the world's going on in that church? Look at that idiot in the parking lot, throwing a fit, kicking his car, beating on the door. I could have gotten mad, driven all the way back home, anger, in a fit, in a rage, and walked into the house and chomped on Shay. How dare you let me forget my keys? And she's like, what are you talking about? I have no idea. In fact, when I walked in, she was startled. Because she knows this is not normal. This is I don't leave. I don't come back. And the first thing she said was, what happened? Well, sure, probably behind that was, well, on earth, something has happened. And I said, I forgot. But I just calmly grabbed my keys, drove back to the church. I guess I could have said, well, okay, it wasn't my stupid carelessness. Oh, okay. And I did think, it's okay, God, what are you saying? Were you protecting me from something, getting me away from the church from something? Is that tree going to fall on the church? I mean, you know, something like that. Or I could have just gotten, you know, all fearful and afraid and think, oh my God, Satan's trying to keep me from the church. Satan's trying to keep me from preaching this message. Satan's trying to, and I could have run to the house and told Shay, lock the doors. Satan's after me. And she said, what in the world are you talking about? He's after me. I forgot my keys. It's a sure sign. The enemy's after me. And he's trying to devour me. I can't leave the house. You say, that's ridiculous, right? But you see, you see my point here. You get the point. I mean, it's not just what's behind coronavirus, what's behind the unraveling of civilization. What's behind everyday little mundane things that either we get so excited about, lessons, or the things that so annoy us, and we get so aggravated about, and we can lose our cool so quick over, right? What's behind it? Listen, what John's fixing to show us, what John's fixing to expose for us, and he's about to lay it open. He is about to expose for us the reality of spiritual warfare. Let me ask you this question. Do you really want to know what's behind it? I mean, do you really want to know? Do you really want to know what's behind that ridiculous, impossible boss? Do you really want to know what's behind those things that just set you off in an instant, and they happen at times, and you think, where in the world are they? Do you really want to know what's behind those thoughts you think sometimes? We do. You want to see it? Do you really want to know what's behind our struggle? Because we can look at it in a natural sense, in a scientific sense. And for a lot of things, yeah, we can say, yeah, these are, you know, coronavirus is a virus. It's a virus. There's viruses in nature. This thing happened. And we can give that kind of explanation and go on and totally miss something. Totally miss something. Do you really want to know what's behind our struggle? Let me probe just a little bit deeper. This, our struggle as God's people, as a church, as His people trying to follow Him now. Do you really want to know what awaits us before we reach glory? Do we really want to know? I'm going to tell you what John's about to expose is not for the faint of heart. what he's about to expose is not the prosperity gospel of just come to Jesus and you're going to be healthy, wealthy, and wise and never have any more problems, never have any more troubles, and life is going to be grand and it's just going to be a rocket ride. But that's been our view of Christianity. That's been our view of the gospel. John's about to expose what's really behind this whole thing. He's going to show us. He's going to expose it in two ways. The first thing he's going to do is he's going to show us the what. I mean, what is it? And then he's going to go in and he's going to explain the why of all. He's going to explain the why of all. Revelation chapter 12, we're in this break again. 12, 13, and 14, we get to this break. The seventh trumpet is sounded at the end of chapter 11. We were in a break in chapter 10, the first part of chapter 11. The seventh trumpet sounds, but before we get to the seven vials, the seven bowls of judgment, the end judgment there, we get this other break. Now, this is not just the middle part or just the halfway point in the book of Revelation, because we're about the halfway point. You're just reading through it. This is about a halfway break. Actually, 12, 13, and 14 is I think, placed here because this is really giving us, in these three chapters, this little break, it's sort of like, some writers have said, it's giving us the theological center of the book of Revelation. It's giving us the theological center of the book of Revelation. And chapter 12 starts with this spiritual warfare. It starts with something that, again, this is not for the faint of heart. And so he's going to expose it by first showing us the what, and then he's going to show us the why. Well, look at the what, because there's three characters in Revelation 12, verse 1. He starts this way, and a great sign. Now remember, Revelation is apocalyptic literature. It's full of signs and symbolisms. So these things stand for certain things, and we need to try to get behind it and see what do these things represent. So John says, in a great sign appeared in the heaven. And here's the first sign. A woman, and she's clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. What a woman, right? So this sign appears, John sees it, and there's this woman. And again, notice, she's clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, on her head a crown of 12 stars. Crown here is Stephanos. It's a victor's crown. It's the crown that you would see at like the Olympic Games and the games they would have in which you would put this wreath around your head and it was a victor's crown. Alright? Keep that in mind. Verse 2 says she was pregnant. This woman in this sign, she sees her, clothed with the sun, moon under her feet, this crown of 12 stars, this wreath, this victory wreath of 12 stars. She was pregnant and she's crying out in birth pains. She is in agony. She is about to give birth. And that's what he said. She was pregnant. She was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. Here's the fact. Here's this woman. Here's what she looks like. Here's her appearance. And she is about to give birth. I've had the privilege. I wasn't sure that I could do it. When Shay was pregnant with Will, her first child, I didn't know if I could be in that room. But you know what? I was in there. I was with her, all four of our children. I was right there. And it's a blessing I'll cherish and never, ever forget to see them draw their first breath and be there. But I tell you what, until that time, and on two occasions, Shay didn't get her epidural. And she was happy. But then when she gave birth, man, it was like, just is all over, here's the baby. So this woman, here she is. She's pregnant. She's crying out in labor pains. And why? Because she's about to give birth. Now notice here comes another sign, verse 3. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon. A great red dragon. I want you to notice, too, the way it's put. When we see the first sign, John just simply says, and the great sign appeared in heaven, and there was a woman. Then when you get to the second sign, he says, and another, in addition to this first sign, there was another sign, and it appeared in the heaven, and behold, look! And what was it? It's a great red dragon. Red, fierce, ferocious, death, all of that. But as we go through this and we see his countenance, and we see it red, probably he's angry. Right? You don't say, oh man, you're so mad your face is pink. Right? We don't say that. You're so mad, man, your face is turning what? Red. So here's this red dragon. And notice he has 7 heads, 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. He has crowns, but it's not victor crown. It's not stephanos. It's diadem. It's a metal crown. It's a crown of royalty. And this is a false claim of his. He makes this false claim that he has this authority, that he's royal, that he controls it all. So here's this red dragon. And notice verse 4, and his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman. He stands before the woman. Now, I just have to tell you, this is a shocking scene. There's no other way to put it. I mean, the language here is shocking. The language here is, in a sense, grotesque. Okay? This woman, in pain, this red dragon standing before the woman. She's about to give birth. And why is he standing there? Not to welcome this child into the world and to celebrate the birth of the child. He's standing there so that when she bore the child, when she gives birth to the child, he might devour. Now, devour is a strong word. It is a strong word. He's going to destroy it. He's going to destroy it. Man, what a scene, right? But two signs. But then notice this, because there's a third character here. She gave birth to a male child. Notice the description of this child, one who is to rule. It's literally shepherd. He is to shepherd the nations with a rod of iron. I don't think rod of iron here means so much in his strength and fierceness as much as it is in his authority. He's going to have the authority to shepherd the nations. But her child was caught up to God and his throne. The child's born, and then in this sign, what John sees, the child's born, and then poof, he's gone. Caught up to God and his throne. And the woman fled after this. She fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. Now, I'm not going to take the time to go back into the 1,260 days. Other than, you know, when we were in chapter 11 and we get to this time, and we'll see it again, time and half time. But this 1,260 days, 42 months, 3.5 years, I've already told you, I think it's symbolic. I think it's code. I think it's code going all the way back to the Maccabean Rebellion and so forth. And what it would stand for in their minds is a period of time of intense persecution. But it's short. It's limited. It's not 7 years. Seven is full. Guess what? Seven's coming. But it's limited. And it's a time of intense persecution. It's a time of intense struggle. So the woman flees into the wilderness. Now, this is full, too. Behind a lot of this is so much of the Exodus event. Remember when they leave and they cross the Red Sea? Where did they go? They fled into the wilderness. Who was chasing them? Pharaoh's chasing them. What does God do? Destroys Pharaoh in the Red Sea, and they're delivered. They're in the wilderness. Now, a lot of stupid stuff happened in the wilderness. But God nourished them, didn't he? He fed them, right? He cared for them. There was the manna in the wilderness. There was the water at times. So this is the what. This is the what of what John first exposes. Here are these signs. Now the question then becomes, okay, who's the woman, right? Well, let me start with the dragon and the child first, because they're easy. Who's the child? It's Christ. This is the birth of the Messiah. Well, then why didn't John say anything about, he just says he's born and then he's called up into heaven. John goes immediately from his birth to his ascension. Why didn't he say anything about his life, his death? Because normally, when the focus is on the Messiah, that's what we get, right? Do you remember all the way back in chapter 4 and 5? Do you remember how I told you chapters 4 and 5 set the stage for the rest of the book of Revelation? It's in chapters 4 and chapter 5 that John goes into detail about the death of Christ. Remember that? The Lamb, the only one worthy to come loose the seals. And it's the Lamb, the one that was slain, the Lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world. So his focus and purpose is not on the Lamb here. It's not on the Messiah here. The focus of what John is focusing on here is the followers of the Lamb. The dragon, obvious, because verse 9, you notice that the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. Satan, that's the red dragon. The male child here, Christ. Satan wants to destroy Christ. He wanted to devour the Messiah. Did he try to do it? Remember Herod and the infants? You remember at the beginning of his public ministry? You remember when he comes to him in the temptations? Did he try to do it? You bet he tried to do it. Absolutely. Go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. The first preaching of the gospel in Genesis 3, verse 15, when the curse is placed on the serpent. God says to the serpent, you're going to bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head. He's going to deal you a death blow. He's known it all along. He's known it all along, and that's going to become clear. So then the question becomes, then who's the woman? Well, there's only, I think, two viable options. I won't spend a great deal of time on getting into this, but there's only two, I think, viable options. One would be to see the woman as national Israel. And if this is national Israel, then we're dealing with something that's in the future, and it's during the tribulation time, and national Israel. And there are places where Israel is talked about as being in birth pains until the Messiah. And some have said this is connected with Genesis chapter 37, Joseph's dream. Joseph has a dream, and he sees sun, moon, stars, and when he tells Jacob the dream, Jacob says, what are you, nuts? You think our family, you think we're going to bow down and worship you? And so that's the way he took the dream, but there's some problems with all of it. I think the woman is not national. I think the woman is the people of God, the ideal people, made up both of Jews and Gentiles. In other words, it's Old Testament believers and New Testament believers. Paul says to the Galatians in Galatians chapter 4, he talks about the heavenly Jerusalem. And he makes an interesting statement when he says the heavenly Jerusalem is free. It's of us, it's free. And then he says this heavenly Jerusalem is the mother of us all. I think, given the context and the subject matter and the way these visions, when we get to the why, it just makes sense that the woman here is the people of God. And there is this sense in which the Messiah, the people of God, and the Bible talks about this in some places using certain types of language, give birth to the Messiah. Now you'll see, I think it'll make sense as we go through this. So that's the what. That's the what. Two signs, a woman, a dragon, and a male child. Now notice as he gets into the why in verse 7. Here we come to the why. Now war arose in heaven. Mighty. Michael the Archangel. We've seen Michael in the book of Daniel. Remember the book of Daniel? Michael the Archangel. Jude mentions Michael. And he mentions Michael as having contending with the devil. He has this dispute about the body of Moses. But Jude says Michael did not presume to pronounce a blasphemous judgment on the devil. He just simply said, "The Lord rebuke." So we've seen Michael before, but there's a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. There's this battle. There's this cosmic war that takes place. Now, the thing that we immediately want to try to understand is, when did this war happen? Now, again, we could get bogged down in so many details here. Did this war happen somewhere way back? Somewhere by the time we end Genesis chapter 2 in creation and everything is good, and then all of a sudden Genesis 3, and there's the serpent, and there's evil, and there he is tempting Eve, and there is sin, enters the picture, and all of God's creation plunged into sin. Did something happen there? You read Isaiah 14, you see a description there of Lucifer and a fall of Lucifer. And then you go to Ezekiel 28, and that description of the fall of the king of Tyre, this is a description of what took place where Satan, somehow, this created cherub, this created angel of God, somehow filled with so much pride, decides he wants to be God, rebels in heaven. His tail sweeps a third of the stars. He somehow convinced angels to go with him, and this is where we get demons. I mean, there's still some unanswered questions. But is that the war? Or is the war, is this all future? Is this all tribulation stuff? There's a national, in the woman's national Israel, and Satan's going to go after Israel in the tribulation. There's a war that's going to take place then. Or is this war somehow a reference to the cross? In Colossians, Paul says that when Jesus died, he defeated Satan. He defeated these principalities. Then go back to Genesis 3:15. He's going to crush your head. Well, there's a war. This war between Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels, they fight back. But he was defeated. The dragon's defeated. And there's no longer any place for them in heaven. He's defeated, and it says here that there was no longer any place, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. He loses. He's thrown out of heaven. He's cast to the earth, and all of his followers with him. That must have been some battle, right? Now, let me give you a couple of givens here. All right, as we talk about this war, because I think it goes back to us talking about spiritual warfare. Here are a couple of facts. One, God exists. I don't think I have to convince you of that. Two, Satan exists. He's real. He's personal. He's a created being. He's not God. He can't be everywhere in one place. He can't be everywhere present like God can. He's not all-powerful. He's not all-knowing. He's not, but he's real, he's personal, and as Luther said in The Mighty Fortress Is Our God, on earth, it's not his evil. On earth, it's not his evil. But he's not God. The other thing, the other fact we have to understand is this, how we view history as a believer, as Christians. We see history, and we've talked about this, there's a beginning and there's an end. And everything in between, there's a history. God's moving things along. He's working his plan. He's working his will. History's not random. History's not just spiraling and we don't know where it's going. And we just don't know. We'll wake up tomorrow and who knows what random thing's going to happen. Everything's working according to his plan, according to his will. And there is a spiritual warfare that's taking place. This war happens. This cosmic battle. Satan loses. Satan's defeated. He's cast to the earth. And verse 10, there comes this great hymn after this, and I heard a loud voice in heaven, a great voice in heaven, saying, "Now salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. The accuser of our brothers." That's Satan. He's an accuser. He's a liar. He's a cheat. He's a murderer from the beginning. He's not our friend. He's an accuser of the brothers, the description here. And what does he do? here the kingdom of our God, the authority of our Christ has come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. He accuses, he brings accusation after accusation after accusation. I have been accused of a lot of things. I have over the years. My motives have been judged. I've been accused of doing things for false motives. I've been called names. I've been accused of a lot of things. And each time I've wanted to say, you don't understand. I'm far worse than you think I am. You want to accuse me? Look, let me pull out my words. But I plead. Comment me with that. And I might agree with you. But I'm going to plead Christ. Because it's not me. So we're going to see that here in just a second. He's an accuser of the brothers. He comes accusation after accusation. He does it to you. How could you be Christian? How could you possibly be a Christian and think that? How could you possibly be a Christian and entertain those thoughts? How could you possibly be a Christian and watch that? How could you possibly be a Christian and say that to that person? How could you possibly be a Christian and think and do? How could you possibly be a Christian? You're no Christian. Accusation after accusation, and there's nothing behind, what's behind these accusations is to try to tear down, bring down, and cause us and put us into a state of panic and fear and doubt. That's Satan. Now, not all doubts are Satan's. Be careful there. That's the way he operates. The world loves to see us. The world loves to throw things at us and say, okay, let's watch them fall. Let's watch them fall. Because you know, the sad reality is a lot of times Christians do fall. Right? We'll get to that in just a second. So there he is. He's accusing, he's throwing these accusations. But he's been defeated. He's been thrown down. And they have conquered him. Verse 11. And they have conquered him. Who is the they? We'll see this in just a second. But it's believers. We have conquered him. We have conquered him. And notice, by the blood of the Lamb first. That's the first thing. We've overcome by the blood of the Lamb. And the second thing, by the word of their testimony. And the third thing, they did not love their life. They were willing to die. That's how they overcame. He comes with his accusations. He comes with in this rage. He comes with this fury. And what do? We plead Christ. We plead the blood of Christ. Not some magical hocus-pocus thing. Sometimes people treat the blood of Christ that way. It is his death. He shed his blood on a cross, was buried, raised the third day. And when he comes, I plead the blood of Christ. Because in that gospel, I understand I'm far worse than you even could imagine. And it's the overcoming of the testimony, their testimony, their word of the testimony. This is not just living a good life. Satan is defeated by us speaking and preaching and teaching the gospel. How does Black Lives Matter get rolled back? How does Antifa get rolled back? How does all this chaos get rolled back? Not by us just sitting at home trying not to sin. It gets rolled back by us being bold and standing and proclaiming the truth of the gospel and praying to God to save them. That's how I get to it. If we're silent, I mean, the church is one generation from being extinct. You realize that? We go, we proclaim. And then also, the third thing, they're not afraid to die. They're not afraid to die. I mean, honestly, what do you do with somebody that you come to them and say, "No, I'm going to kill you, you know, if you don't deny Christ, I'm going to kill you"? Okay, go ahead. The die's game. You're just hastening me on my door. What are you going to do? If you're an interrogator, what do you do with that? You know, these interrogators, they have all these tricks up their sleeve and this psychological manipulation and this and that. But what about a blood-bought believer in the Lord Jesus Christ who's not afraid to die and is sat there and being interrogated, even Satan himself interrogated? "I'm going to kill you." "I don't care. Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. This body they may kill." God's truth, the Bible's truth. You see it? What do you do with that person? That's how they overcome. That's how we overcome. "Even unto death, therefore rejoice," is command, "rejoice, O heaven, and you dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth," here comes a warning, "woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in a great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." He's here. He's been cast down. He's here. And he is angry, and he knows his time is short. Compare that to eternity. Compare it to eternity. And then here we go into the next part of the why, verse 13. "And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child." Now, if this is the ideal people of God, he's going after God's people. He's going after them. He can't get the child. He failed at that. And what does he do? He turns on the woman. And he's going to pursue her. He's going to persecute her. He's going to make her suffer. But the woman was given two wings. Again, Exodus language. It's on the wings of eagles that God lifted his people in the Exodus and provided for them. So the woman was given two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, into this place that has already been prepared for her, where she's going to be fed, she's going to be nourished for time and times and half times. Again, I don't think this is tribulation language here, that this is the second part of the tribulation. I don't think that's this at all. It's code language of when he comes after you, and when there's intense struggle, and when there's persecution, you will be protected. You may die, you may suffer, but you will not face his wrath. You will not face his wrath. "And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood." I have no idea what this is. He's after her, though. "But the earth came. The earth comes to help the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth." The earth, he is the Lord of all, right? Not only is Michael and his angels fighting, but now the earth. Then notice verse 17. "Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off." He goes off to do what? He goes off to make war on the rest of her offspring. You know who that is? It's us. It's you and I. He goes off to make war with the rest of her offspring, and on those, because notice the description here, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. He stands back. He's surveying. Peter's saying, he's like a roaring lion. What is he doing? He's roaming up and down the earth. He's seeking whom he may what?
Devour.
He could not get Christ. He couldn't stop the people of God overall. And so he turns, and what's he going to do? He's going to try to stop us. He turns his guns on us. In fact, he's turned his guns on every generation of believers. And you know what? He will continue to do so until the end. He will continue to do so until the end. But he's defeated. He's defeated. He knows it. He is angry. He's enraged. How do we defeat him? The blood of the Lamb. How do we defeat him? Not in my own strength. I don't defeat him by somehow pulling myself up by my bootstraps, trying to stop sinning, and trying to go to church, and trying to worship, and trying to give my money, and trying to be, you know, good at this and good at that, trying to be a good husband, trying to be a good father, trying to be a good wife, mother, whatever. I don't defeat him by any of that. In fact, that's the accusations that Satan comes with, because I know I can't do it. And when I can't do it, what does he do? He trips me up. He cripples me. He paralyzes me in my mind. And he brings accusation after accusation. How can you be a Christian and let your children do that? You don't defeat him that way. Let me give you this too. Say this, because if we're not careful, this is another mind trick Satan plays. On the days when I am a good husband, believe it or not, there are days when I'm not. On the days when I'm a good husband, and I love my wife as Christ loved the church, and at the end of that day, I lay my head down, and I feel I'm so close to the next day, and I'm rather. I get up and file with you. I go out the door. I may not even kiss my wife. I may not even say I love you. And I go out. The day just gets bad. It's worse. I had one of those days a couple of weeks ago. Everything I did, just nothing worked. Right? You had this one. Nothing's working. I come home, and I don't want to hear it. I don't care about your day. I don't want to hear about your day. What's for supper? And I lay down that night, and I think, oh, wretched, miserable sinner that I am. You know this game, don't you? You know it because Satan has played it with you. That is nothing. D.A. Carson calls that pagan superstition. Because the grounds of my acceptance with God is not whether I'm a good husband or bad husband. The grounds of my acceptance with God is the shed blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. You see it? That's how I feel. That's how I feel. You can't stand against me. I think James says something. Stand against me. Not arrogant, but stand armed with the gospel. Stand armed with the gospel. Do you believe in only what you can see? Is that all you believe in? Well, if you're trying to get through the life, if you're trying to live the Christian life that way, I mean, I only believe what I can see. Then the possibility is you may be so deceived about some things, because Satan is so deceived you're blind. You may be totally ignoring some things. You may not seeing some things for what they really are. You know, in Ephesians chapter 6, Paul says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. You realize that. There's a spiritual battle. We wrestle against these things. We wrestle against an arch enemy. We wrestle against principalities and principles and things like that. There are things going on behind the scene. It's that person is not your enemy. That boss is not your enemy. That wicked politician is not our enemy. We need to pray that God would save them. There's something behind me. We're not wrestling with this pleasure. We overcome by the blood of the Lamb, our testimony, our faithfulness to the testimony, and our willingness to die, willingness to lay our life down. Donald Gray Barnhouse, great old preacher. Donald Gray Barnhouse wrote a book called The Invisible War. It's a massive thing about just tracing the spiritual order, going all the way back to the very beginning. He sort of lays it out for you. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called Screwtape Letters. In that, this sort of give and take about the schemes and the devil and Screwtape. John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress fame. I love Pilgrim's Progress. This I love as well. This is an allegory called Holy War. This is one people really don't know a lot about John Bunyan. And what he describes is Satan's attack on man's soul. And there's all these characters in all of this. And how does he come? He comes and he decides, he's cast out, he's casting out of him, and he decides he's going after man's soul. He's going to destroy the city of man's soul. Man's soul had these gates: eye gate, ear gate, nose gate, mouth gate, feel gate. And where did he go? He went after those gates. You see where he went after Eve? See where he went after Eve? The desires of the flesh, the pride of life, the eyes. Oh, that looked great. Oh, I'm hungry. You eat it, you'll be God. John in 1 John says, don't love the world. Don't you love this world? And he uses the same theory. Don't you love this world? Don't you bow to this world? Pride of life comes through the eyes, comes through the ears. You arm yourself, as Paul says in Ephesians 6, with the armor of God, the gospel. And we stand up and we don't retreat. We overcome by the blood of the Lamb, the word of our testimony. And if it comes to it, we'll die. We'll die. He is cruel, vengeful, full of rage, hateful. He's all of that. He can't come as an angel of light, but he's all of that. But did you catch in a mighty fortress is our God? God's our fortress. Did you catch what Luther said? One little word will fail. One little word backs him down and causes him to fail. You know what that word is? Jesus. You get up tomorrow and it starts going crazy? Jesus. Accusations come, I believe Jesus. It's going to happen. It's going to happen.